You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, when NASA propelled John Glenn into space, few people knew that four African-American women were the mathematical brains behind the operation. We travel back to that time in the 1960s with an author who knew some of those exceptional women personally.
First, Governor Walker announced on Thursday that Department of Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb resigned from his position. The decision to step down comes shortly after a hearing on Governor Walker's budget and Wisconsin road funding.
WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson is following the story. He joins us now to give us the details. He's at the Capitol. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, were there any reasons given for Secretary Gottlieb's resignation?
No, in fact, if you look at the press release that announced it, any mention of Gottlieb was actually very brief. The press release was entitled, Dave Ross Named New Department of Transportation Secretary. Dave Ross was, until now, the secretary of the another department on safety and professional services. Just one line in there, DOT Secretary Mark Gottlieb offered his resignation to Governor Walker with an effective date of January 6th, 2017. So that's all we know.
And did the governor afterward offer any praise of Secretary Gottlieb?
So that was notably absent from the press release. Typically, when somebody steps down, especially somebody who's been with the administration for 5 years at this point, was one of the governor's first cabinet appointees, along with Secretary Ross, you would have a few lines in there about, I want to thank you for your service, etc. And it wasn't there. It was all about Dave Ross is going to be a great secretary for the DOT. It wasn't about Secretary Gottlieb. Now, the governor did send out a couple tweets, one later that night, one the next day, praising Gottlieb for his service. But in that initial announcement, which kind of set the table for the discussion we're having now, it wasn't there.
And the budget is in the works. Official budget's coming out early next year. But the transportation budget, we already have an idea of what that could look like. And Secretary Gottlieb, he's still secretary until early January. He was up in front of state lawmakers a few weeks ago and didn't necessarily go along with Governor Walker's line on those issues.
Yeah, so that's what makes this announcement all the more significant, because that we already know that transportation funding and the DOT in particular is going to be kind of the central argument of the next budget, or one of them. It's really getting more attention than it's gotten in many previous budgets. Definitely a spotlight there. And a number of members, legislative members, feel like the state has gotten to this tipping point where if we don't start to do something different with transportation funding, it's going to be unsustainable, and the road system that we know 10 years from now is going to look a lot different from the one we're driving on today. So that is the backdrop against which Gottlieb stepped out. I mean, he was just in front of a legislative panel where he was really grilled by Assembly Republicans on his past views on transportation. Gottlieb's been a longtime advocate of increasing or finding a sustainable source of road funding. And how those square up with the governor's views in this budget, which are more straightforward, no new tax increases, no revenue increases, basically, in the transportation fund, that's not what voters want right now. And so, you had that backdrop play out. And as Gottlieb was asked about the governor's budget, he said, here's what the governor believes. We don't want to raise taxes. Now's not the time to raise taxes. But whenever he was pressed on details of what that would mean for the roads, he was pretty straight about it. He said that over the next decade, that if current funding trends continue, that is, if the governor's current proposed budget is basically copied over the next 10 years, you're going to see the number of roads in Wisconsin that are in poor condition double.
Talking to WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the departure of Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb. His resignation was announced earlier this week amid a debate over how to pay for the state's roads, building and maintenance. And Sean, just today, a report came out, looked at toll roads. We'll get into that in a sec. But there was a one-page summary of what's going to happen in the future with different levels of funding. Can you sum that up for us?
Yeah, it would be funny if it weren't so dire, right? So this is the summary. This is a study that actually the legislature put in the budget. So they required this study of the Department of Transportation. And it was basically two parts. The one that you referenced that was looking at new revenue options, and another by the Department of Transportation looking at the conditions of the roads. And really, the DOT study reiterated a lot of the stuff that Mark Gottlieb said in that committee a few weeks ago. But there was one page in particular where they said they laid out three scenarios. Scenario one, spend less. They say what will happen is system conditions worsen severely over the next decade. Scenario two, spend the same. System conditions worsen significantly by 2027. Scenario three, spend above. That is, even if we spend more than what we're spending right now, that the trend, that there's more money coming in, they still say system conditions worsen moderately by 2027. So they laid out these three scenarios where either there's cuts, things stay the same, or more money gets thrown in, and the outcome, according to the DOT, is the roads get worse.
Right. They get less worse with a spending
less worse
increase,
with more funding,
they're saying.
Yes.
So Assembly Republicans, have we heard reaction to Gottlieb's departure?
Well, there was right away, there was a statement from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss really praising Gottlieb, you know, in no uncertain terms. Voss served with Gottlieb in the legislature. Gottlieb was a state lawmaker before he was transportation secretary. So, you know, Voss with a huge defense immediately of Gottlieb and his record and praising what he'd done here and saying that, you know, as we enter this transportation funding debate, his expertise is going to be missed. Mark Gottlieb brought a lot of just technical expertise to the transportation debate. He's somebody who had a background as a civil engineer. So it's not just something that he encountered in the legislature or as mayor of Port Washington, which he was before being elected to the legislature. He's somebody who knew about building roads. And there he was leading this large agency in charge of doing just that.
So he is on his way out. Now, we talked to Speaker Voss earlier this week, or we aired that interview earlier this week. This is all before Secretary Gottlieb's resignation was announced. We've talked, Sean, Speaker Voss did a video of him in the back of an ambulance, mm-hmm. his cousin's ambulance, demonstrating rough road conditions in the Burlington area. Is this an issue that a locally elected legislator is going to have to answer for if the roads aren't right where they're coming from? They're going to hear about it from constituents?
Yeah, I think every legislature is going to view this issue differently, and they're going to view it through that lens of what are the roads like in my district? So what are the roads like in each of these 99 assembly districts, 33 Senate districts? They're all going to have that very unique perspective on things. And if the roads are bad in their district, that is a tangible example of state government at work. And that's the kind of thing that people notice. So, yeah, I think that probably is one of the reasons why you're seeing Republicans infighting on this issue when on other issues they, you know, are more singing from the same hymnal. When it comes to roads, they are willing to mix it up even with their own governor.
And we heard from State Senator Jennifer Schilling, Senate Minority Leader, a Democrat. Talked to her again before this resignation was announced, but she was critical of Republicans for infighting, not getting the road situation solved. Are we going to be hearing this as a theme from Democrats?
They're on the sidelines for this. So the approach that they take is really up to them. One thing that it sounded like Senator Schilling was floating early on was that, you know, this was essentially a mess that Republicans had to clean up and that Democrats were going to, you know, I don't want to misquote her here, but when you're in the minority party and the majority party has a mess, there's one school of thought that says stand back and let them sort of tussle over this. You know, if they're going to pass some kind of a tax increase to pay for roads or take a vote on a tax increase, the Democrats will have to kind of evaluate whether they want to take those votes along with them and potentially offer some type of a solution that may ultimately get vetoed by a governor, or whether they want to take kind of a hands-off approach and let Republicans squirm.
We'll leave it there for now. Sean, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. He joined us to talk about the recent resignation of the State Department of Transportation Secretary Mark Gottlieb. On February 20th, 1962, NASA launched one of the most important space flights in American history when it sent astronaut John Glenn into orbit around the Earth.
That stunning achievement would not have been possible without the work of four African-American women who served as the brains behind that historic flight. In the segregated 1950s and 60s, these women calculated the rocket trajectories for NASA's first successful space missions.
The four women, Dorothy Vaughan, Mary Jackson, Katherine Johnson, and Christine Darden were known at the time as the colored computers. Because of their work, John Glenn became the first American astronaut to orbit the Earth, and NASA managed to catch up with the Soviet Union in the space race.
Margot Lee Shetterly joins us now. She's a journalist and author of Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold True Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. She's the daughter of one of NASA's early black engineers and grew up knowing many of the women in the book. Margot, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judah. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sure. Well, Hidden Figures has been made into a major motion picture, which just hit some theaters and will go into full release January 4th. Let's listen to a short clip from the movie.
That's John Glenn.
What do you guys do for NASA?
Calculate your launch and landing site. How could you be ogling these white men?
This equal rights. I have the right to see fine in every color. Oh,
if you were a white male, would you wish to be an engineer?
I wouldn't have to. I'd already be one.
Yes, it's an uphill battle.
Get it, girl. But yes, who else is
playing? So, Margot, you're the daughter of one of NASA's first black engineers, and you grew up knowing some of the women you write about in the book. Take us back to that time in the 1960s. How would you describe what it was like for these four women working at NASA?
Right. So first, I just want to make it clear that though I focus on four women in the book, they were really part of a very large cohort of women, black, white, all backgrounds, who were doing this work of human computing. So today we think of a computer as just the electronic devices that basically do everything for us. But for most of human history, a computer was a job title. It was a person whose job it was to compute, to do mathematics all day. And these particular women, they started out, NASA originally was working on airplanes, and these women were also working on airplanes. But when the Russians put the Sputnik satellite into space in 1957, and the NACA, which was working on aeronautics, became NASA, these women and many engineers and around the country, but there at the Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia, focused on space. They turned their mathematical minds to orbital trajectories and reentry angles and everything that was necessary in order to send a human into space and bring them back home again.
And, Marco, we're having a little disturbance with the line right now, so we're going to actually call you back and hopefully get a little better connection. We are talking with Margot Lee Shetterly. She's a journalist and author of Hidden Figures, The American Dream and the Untold True Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. She herself is the daughter of one of NASA's early black engineers, and she grew up knowing some of the women in the book, and she tells the story of their lives and also really putting it into a context of the space race and how important it was for the U.S. and Russia, who were competing on that.
And this is, you may have seen trailers already for the movie Hidden Figures that is based on this book, a movie I'm looking forward to seeing when it comes out early in the new year. We're getting Margot Lee Shetterly back on the line now after some line difficulties. I'll hopefully have her up in just a few moments.
And coming up, we'll be talking about a new course that's being offered at UW-Madison. It's brought some controversy to the state from nationwide sources. We're going to talk about the class and why it's so polarizing in just a minute.
And looks like we have Margot Lee Shetterly back on the line.
All right, Margot, thanks so much. Great. So these four women who you profile were doing extremely complex and crucial work, like calculating rocket trajectories, and yet they were being segregated from their white counterparts. How did they overcome the racial discrimination that they were living, and how could they be so effective in their roles given that?
Yeah, well, we have to remember that, you know, when these women started work, and the first computers, actually, the first African-American women working, doing this job, started, like so many things during in our society, during World War II, and they stayed in the job on into the space race. And we're talking about Virginia in the Jim Crow South, where racial segregation was a legal necessity. So these women were put into a separate office. Technically, they were called the West Area Computing Office, but colloquially, they were known as the colored computers. Mm. And although they did the same work as their white female counterparts, who were also, you know, working in a computing pool doing this mathematical calculations, they were also forced to use a colored bathroom and sit at a segregated table in the cafeteria. So, you know, despite this, they did manage to, and, you know, they were talking about women who were at the top of their classes when they graduated from college in math, who were, you know, extremely good at math. They were able to, through excellence in their work, really start to move up and to get close to the engineers who were doing this hands-on work for the astronauts.
And where did they get their educations? Were they going to traditionally black colleges, or had they already, you know, kind of made that leap into a dominant white world?
Now, this is one of the other great stories about of this history. Most of these women, the black women, were graduates of historically black colleges. They came from Hampton Institute, it's now called Hampton University, but which is right across town from Langley. They came from Howard University. They came from West Virginia State. So many of the women, all of them really in those early days, were the products of black colleges. And interestingly, most of the white women were graduates of women's colleges. Mm. So black colleges and women's colleges were really responsible for feeding our need for computing power during the, you know, the large part of the 20th century.
There has been a lot of talk over the years of the glass ceiling that often keeps women in out of the top levels of management and leadership in corporations and in government agencies, things like that. Well, in the late 1950s, one of the women who you profile, Katherine Johnson, managed to join what were traditionally all-male meetings at NASA, and she was doing that not just as a woman, but as a black woman. So how did she manage to elbow her way in to sit at that table?
Well, I think there were probably three things. One was sheer talent. You know, I mean, this is the kind of job that you don't get through the door if you're not good at it. That's just the simple fact. You know, you have to be able to literally do the math in order to get in the door. The second thing is persistence. You know, and one of the things that characterized Katherine and so many of the other women who over time moved up and really got positions of responsibility is they simply refused to take no for an answer. So if the engineer said, listen, you know, you can't come to the meeting, they questioned them and pushed until they were allowed into the meeting. And then I think, you know, particularly in the case of Katherine Johnson, you know, she is a charismatic, compelling, very charming person. You know, she's someone that is just so engaged and engaging and had a passion for her work. So, you know, I think all of those qualities, intellectual and personal, were the things that really allowed her to stand out from the crowd and to make the case that she was, in fact, the right person at the right time.
Oh, and speaking of Katherine Johnson, last year President Obama awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to her. She is now 98 years old. Have any of the other women been acknowledged for their tremendous contributions?
You know, they haven't all been acknowledged. Christine Darden, who is just 74 years old, she is somebody who really did stand on the shoulders of these other women and is known within the aeronautical community as really a top practitioner in that field. Mary Jackson was somebody who received an Apollo Achievement Award for some of her work on the Apollo missions. And, you know, Dorothy Vaughan, really, she was one of the earliest computers to come to Langley. She was made the head of the segregated West computing pool. And really, to this point, she was someone who was kind of lost to history. So I think it's just a wonderful thing that we are in a moment where we, you know, get to look at her work and not just her personal career, but the amazing influence that she had on other women's careers. She was a fierce, fierce advocate for the women who worked for her. So she's, you know, I think it's just wonderful that we're finally celebrating her as well.
Here we are more than 50 years later after these four women made this tremendous contribution, but African Americans still constitute a disproportionately low number of students in math and science-based school and university programs. What hurdles do you see people of color still facing when it comes to studying in these fields?
You know, honestly, I think one of the things that is true, and this is something that, you know, was one of the strengths of the women who were in this story, is that they tend to be very isolated, and it's very hard for them to see other people who look like them in the classes, you know, other people of color, other women, you know, and I think that I'm hoping, really, that one of the things that the book and the movie will do will sort of, you know, put a mirror to those people who are already working in the profession and who have had successes in years past, and really that students of today who may have innate mathematical talent or scientific talent, but, you know, for a number of reasons feel that the field is not for them, that they may reconsider.
Well, Margot, thank you so much for spending the time with us today and for sharing this story with us, but also through the book. And I have to imagine it's pretty thrilling to know there's a movie coming out.
It's very exciting. I'm excited, and all of Hampton, Virginia is very, very excited.
That was Margot Lee Shetterly, journalist and author of Hidden Figures, The American Dream, and the Untold True Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. She's the daughter herself of one of NASA's early black engineers and grew up knowing many of the women in the book. The film version of the story is currently out in some theaters and will go into nationwide release January 4th.
A new course being offered at the University of Wisconsin-Madison has generated controversy in Wisconsin and beyond.
The course is called The Problem of Whiteness, and it explores the social construction of race. It also takes a look at how white people, either intentionally or not, perpetrate and perpetuate institutional racism.
But the course has proven to be controversial nationwide, and some state lawmakers are calling for the course to be canceled and the professor fired.
And some state lawmakers have even called for funding to be withheld from the university as a result of the course.
Scott Jasek joins us now. He's the editor at Inside Higher Ed, which has been following and writing about this story. Scott, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Well, you watch issues around the country. What's looking at Wisconsin from the outside here, what do you think it is that people are taking issue with in regards to this course, The Problem of Whiteness?
I think a lot of it has to do with the name. I think if you look at what the course says it's going to cover and the books being read, these are topics covered in courses all over the country. It doesn't strike me as a unusual course or unusual topics. Lots of classes look at issues of race, and part of looking at race involves looking at white people. So I think it's the name that somehow stunned people. I also think a lot of people are viewing the problem in a way that maybe isn't quite what the professor may mean. You know, a lot of people in academia talk about the problems to analyze, let's problematize this, frequently means that there are issues involved. I don't read the course description as saying that white people are bad or even that they're all alike. This is the kind of course you see offered all over the place.
Yeah, as I read the course description and digging through some academic language, definitely the idea seems to be researchers, sociologists, and others have treated black people as an identity with a problem or to solve, not that they are a problem, but there's an issue here that we're trying to sort out, and that type of thinking, if I read the course direction the way it's intended, hasn't been applied as much to white people.
Yes, and that, you know, in fact, you could see people criticizing minority studies programs for not acknowledging white people. I mean, you know, there's sort of a catch-22 here, but this course is acknowledging that white people have a range of experiences and that race is defined in certain ways that apply to white people and to non-white people. that I do think it's the course title that grabbed people and that people seem to have focused on.
Do we see issues like this elsewhere in the country with specific courses, maybe even course titles, generating this kind of response?
Sure. You see it with course titles. You see it with, when scholarly groups meet and people look at the titles of some of the panels. And many times people just don't understand what it's about. Now, they may understand and disagree as well, or learn more and disagree, but sort of provocative titles are common in academia, whether you're talking about a course name or a article in a journal or a conference title. I think, you really do need to look at what is the substance, not just the title.
Is part of the problem here maybe on academia in the sense that they speak a language that other people don't, and maybe it would be better if they talked in more plain terms that would allow them to communicate with the rest of the world and state lawmakers, say?
Certainly when things come up, it's important to explain what's going on. On the other hand, academia, when people are writing their course titles, they're thinking about what will appeal to students and how to communicate to students what the course is about. There are all parts of our society that have their own jargon and language. And, if I were reading a stock offering from a company, that probably would have language I wouldn't understand as a journalist and somebody who follows higher education. So I do think there is, in some quarters at least, a willingness to mock academic conventions that maybe they don't apply to other aspects of society, which also have unusual language and jargon.
Talking to Scott Jasek from Inside Higher Ed, looking at the controversy in Wisconsin. It's gotten some national attention over a UW-Madison course titled The Problem of Whiteness, aimed at studying what it means to be a white person, not just in the United States, but around the world. A Republican State Representative Dave Murphy talked to WPR reporter Avery Brookins last week. He told her he thought the course could be divisive. Here's a listen.
I think we would like to bring people together rather than trying to divide them.
And Scott, you mentioned earlier a lot of courses look at issues of race and focusing on a particular race or identity. Does it have this divisive potential, whether we're talking about a course on white people, African Americans, you name it?
Well, it probably has the potential to challenge what some students think going in. Many people would say that that's part of the mission of higher education, to challenge us all. The question is, are students free to express their views, to challenge the ideas? If so, the fact that not everyone agrees isn't necessarily a problem. In fact, it might be a good thing about higher education. You know, if you apply the standard of everyone agreeing, there are a lot of things you might not teach. I'm sure there are courses at Madison that note climate change. Well, not everyone agrees with climate change. Should those courses be stopped, even though most scientists say that climate change is real? Lots of courses challenge lots of people's ideas, and that's part of higher education.
One response I've seen, a conservative writer and former law professor in the state said, you know, keep the class, sure, and lawmakers shouldn't be telling university what to do, but liberal or left perspectives, progressive perspectives are overrepresented in universities, especially in the liberal arts. Why not have more conservative leaning classes in those departments? Is there something to that?
There's been a lot of research that many universities do lean left in the politics of some of their faculty members. On the other hand, you have to go to different parts of the university. May not be true, say, of a business school, and it may be different in other institutions. I think the question is, are institutions open to hiring people of all philosophies, of all do they provide opportunities for people to debate issues? Again, lots of parts of our society don't necessarily have equal numbers of people in different who hold different political views. But most certainly, I think if you look at the range of views taught at Madison, they may seem lopsided one way, but there are conservatives at Madison. And so when people say there are none, I tend to question that.
This is all happening with a budget just around the corner. The budget session will start up a few months into 2017, and some of the lawmakers objecting to this class and the professor teaching it have hinted that they would not be open to restoring past budget cuts or possible budget increases. Have we seen that in other states, leverage of the purse strings used over the content of classes?
Well, you certainly see threats of it periodically when there's a controversy over course. It's less common for them to totally follow through on it. And a lot of people will be watching to see what happens here. As you know, there's been a lot of controversy in Wisconsin in the past few years over changes in tenure and faculty rights at the university system. People would, from outside Wisconsin, I think would take note and be concerned if courses were called off because they offended certain legislators. It's also, again, important to remember that there are a range of views. My guess is there may be economics courses or courses in the business school that maybe promote gaining of wealth, that maybe there's some far-left legislator who is offended by that. Would you want that legislator saying, don't teach that course? The way you decide which courses to teach isn't through legislative votes.
Talking to Scott Jasek. He's the editor of Inside Higher Ed. They've been following the controversy surrounding the UW-Madison course, The Problem of Whiteness.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the controversy? And should the UW system and universities in general offer these types of courses? Have you ever taken a college course that tackled the issue of race and white privilege? And if you are either a faculty member or a student at UW-Madison, we'd especially like to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the controversy surrounding a course that's being offered at UW-Madison. It's called The Problem of Whiteness. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Should state lawmakers have a say in courses like this? And should they withhold funding if they don't like courses offered by the UW system? Again, 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Scott Jasek is with us. He's editor of Inside Higher Ed, which has been following this story. Let's go to our callers now. Dave is on the line in Toma. Dave, hi.
Yeah, hi. Mr. Jasek sounds like the liberal people that a lot of us are complaining about. And how would he feel? Should we have a class, the problem with blackness?
Dave,
I'm kind of tired of everything being blamed on somebody else. If I was a progressive black, I'd be embarrassed by the things that go on in our country, like the riots at the malls this week and things.
Dave, thanks for the call. The problem of whiteness, not with whiteness, is the title of the call. But this is a common point that's been raised, Scott. What substitute problem of blackness or women or whatever? Would other people have a problem with that title?
I mean, no doubt some people will object to any title. But again, I do not view this course as saying that white people are bad, that white people are responsible for all racial problems. What I see this course, just reading the description, as being about is looking at the way race relates to white people, their identities, and so forth. So yes, if there were a course saying white people are bad, yes, of course that would be wrong. And if there were a course saying black people are bad, that would be wrong. I think if you look at what's going on here, they're talking about the way race is defined, the role that racial identities play in our society, and white people are part of that. I don't see this as saying that all white people are bad.
Thanks for the call, Dave. We'll go next to Josh on the line in Portage. Josh, hi.
Hey. I was calling in regards to the heated topic you guys got there. I was telling a gal on the phone there that I attended college for law enforcement criminal justice, and we actually took a class called Race, Class, and Gender, and that class taught us about individuals of all races and how their historical racial identities, you know, factored into, you know, their futures and how they interacted with not only law enforcement but members of society. And I think that that's ultimately what that class is, you know, trying to do. And I think, you know, the title of the class, some may perceive that as being controversial, but ultimately it's just getting down to, you know, the nitty-gritty with, you know, what ultimately will be one of the topics, you know, being discussed. At the end of the day, those folks are going to walk out of that classroom with, you know, the experience and the knowledge of, you know, how, you know, being raised Indian or black or Asian or white, you know, differs from one another, and how your interactions with them and your viewpoints on many different topics that we deal with in life will vary.
Gotcha, Josh. Thanks a lot for the call. Scott, what do you think?
Well, I think it's interesting that this caller studied race, class, and gender while preparing to study law enforcement or for career law enforcement. And I think that what that shows, and this is true generally, is that a lot of the reasons that people study issues of race aren't just to study race, but because they want to be better in law enforcement or education or healthcare. So the relevance to having a better understanding of race just extends to lots of parts of our society.
We're next to Jesse on the line in Shell Lake. Jesse, hi.
Hey, I just had a question. I think the class in and of itself is okay, but my question is how much of that class is instructor-driven as far as, like, their own motivation? Because I think you see it across the country in lots of universities that a lot of the classes tend to be, you know, instructor-motivated as far as their opinions and their ideas. So I think the class, as long as it's you go in being able to get information and set your own opinion, is fine. So my question being, how much of that is instructor-driven?
Interesting, Jesse. Thanks for bringing that up. Scott, the class hasn't happened yet, so we can't evaluate that. But in general, how does a university make sure that the class is giving good information perspectives and isn't just a platform for the views of a professor?
Sure. Well, look, many again, it's important to remember, we're talking about higher education and college students here. We're talking about people who have already, you know, we're not talking about elementary school students. So many professors express a point of view. You know, I can remember in my college education taking courses from professors with a range of views. And the question to me isn't, does the professor express a point of view? The question is, are all ideas welcome? Can students disagree with a professor? Many would argue, and actually there have been books about this, many conservative students feel that they get stronger in their conservative beliefs by studying with liberals and vice versa. So I would focus less on, does the professor have an opinion, which almost certainly the professor does, than what's the class like. And again, this is not a class that's already being taught, so I have no information on that. But a professor having an opinion doesn't mean students are treated unfairly.
We'll leave it there. Thanks for your calls. And Scott, thanks to you.
Thank you.
That's Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Ed. He joined us to talk about the controversy around the Problem of Whiteness course being offered at UW-Madison, as lawmakers in the school at odds over academic freedom issues.
And special thanks to WPER reporter Avery Brookins for audio that was used in the interview.